We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're looking at the Space 1999 episode, The Troubled Spirit. As the moon drifts through the vast, empty tracts of space, the Alphans amuse themselves with a little musical concert. As the music fills the halls of Alpha, an experiment is being conducted. Dan Matteo and three other scientists conduct a seance-like experiment in an effort to communicate with plants. Yes, I said plants. Something goes wrong, though, and Matteo slips into a trance. The head of hydroponics, Warren, tries to break up the experiment, and a bizarre, windy force is unleashed on Alpha. Matteo collapses and is taken to the medical center. He awakens and appears to be fine. He tells Dr. Russell that he experienced cold and dread during the experiment, but that his work must continue. She sedates him so he can get a good night's sleep. Later that night, a bizarre figure beckons to and terrifies Dr. Russell, but there is no one there. Matteo returns to work, where he threatens Warren. Minutes later, Warren is killed by the ghostly figure. When Helena examines the body, she realizes the spinal cord has been crushed. Not possible that it was caused by a blow. She concludes that it must have been done by fear. Unimaginably concentrated fear. Well, not unimaginably, because she just imagined the idea. Bergman has been studying readings and concludes that a psychic energy force was unleashed by Matteo's experiments. Matteo scoffs at the idea. They were just using technology in a seance to link their mental energies to try to communicate with plants. He doesn't buy this psychic nonsense. But first, they need to convince a skeptical command staff. They're scientists, damn it, and they don't believe in all this supernatural stuff. Bergman assures them that he doesn't believe it's supernatural, just paranormal. Well, that's okay then, say the skeptical scientists. Meanwhile, Matteo tries to rebuild his machine. He's right, damn it. Talking to plants could be the edge to survival that the Alphans need in space, and his work must continue. His girlfriend tries to stop him, so the ghostly creature kills her. Matteo now accepts that he is somehow to blame. They hold another science seance, this time with everyone on the command staff. As Matteo lapses into a trance, the mysterious figure appears. It is Matteo, scarred and disfigured. He speaks and says that he used to be Matteo, but that they killed him and he will take revenge on him. Matteo wakes up and they touch, and the ghost disappears. Bergman convinces John that they need to handle this thing exactly like a haunting, and they will need to perform an exorcism. Just like that. Only not at all like that. Instead, they lock Matteo in the medical center and surround him with death rays. He is strapped into a chair and pumped full of chemicals that will cause him to rage uncontrollably. The hope is the death rays will destroy the apparition. It contains it for a time, but Matteo wakes up, breaks free, battles with his ghost, and the ghost pushes him into the death ray, killing him. The apparition dies too and fades away. Matteo's death is identical to the scars on the apparition. He has come full circle. Afterwards, Koenig is philosophical. Life after death, maybe, maybe not. But a man's ghost haunting himself before he's even dead? What's that about? Okay, so, The Troubled Spirit. The Troubled Spirit. Mm-hmm. Space 1999's foray into the sitar. What'd you think of the episode?
Well, in terms of some of the aesthetics, I enjoyed it. You made fun of the, you know, I remember you told me or warned me about the sitar, but I actually really dug the sitar music.
Okay.
In a big way. I was really enjoying it and was very happy to see. I was watching very carefully the musician who was playing it, and that, I mean, I don't know if he was playing it live per se. But his fingerings and technique were spot on, so I was happy about that.
Good, because I was going to ask you about that. I mean, I know it's a sitar. I recognize the sound of a sitar.
That's actually called a sitar guitar.
Okay, that was my question, because I know George Harrison was all sitar, and I know the sound of a sitar, and of course I have that soundtrack for Space 1999, so I've heard those tracks countless times. Mm-hmm. And sitar in my mind always, I know that's a sitar. It sounds like a sitar. Then when I watch the episode, he's sitting there playing a guitar.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not a sitar. Wait a minute. Am I like being fed a bill of goods here? And I wanted to ask you about it as the musician. Is that like, that the real thing that was being played, or did they just hand him a guitar and say, play this and we'll dub some music over it?
That is an actual instrument. It's very rare. They are very expensive. They were very popular among English musicians, rock musicians in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Very popular, especially among progressive rock artists. They liked to use it in their music, you know, like groups like Yes. You know, they liked using that kind of sound. So, yeah, it's an actual instrument.
And the beauty of Alpha is with the look of the scientists and all the people on the moon base, because of that 70s, early 70s look, they can just, like, grab a musician and stick him in a moon base uniform, and he looks convincingly like one of the sort of people that they would have on board the moon base.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't matter what his facial hair looks like or anything. I mean, I'm just going to, I easily believe that's one of the crew members of the thing. So.
Yeah, I mean, as we've seen, especially in this episode and in so many others already, I mean, there are, God knows how many different science departments are there on Alpha. So it's very easy to accept that there's, I mean, okay, so once again, how many people are supposed to be on Alpha?
It was 311 when they left the Earth's orbit.
I'm sure it's significantly less by now. But I'm sure there are still plenty of science departments that we never hear about, or, you know, whatever, that this gentleman could have been a part of. And he just happened to bring his guitar with him because
you
musicians
live on the moon for 18 months. Yeah, no.
Well, musicians like to do that.
Yeah, no, I have absolutely no problem with that. And I think it's far more realistic than the nonsense we see on Star Trek The Next Generation, where, of course, they can replicate anything they want. So, which, you know, we're going to have Night in the 10 Forward where a three cello quartet's going to play.
Right.
You know, this was a little more realistic because clearly, you know, this is just a guy. And, well, okay, what the heck? Why not? I was going to say, this is clearly just a guy, and he's going to put on a show because they're probably bored freaking senseless. And,
absolutely. You
know, they got some room there, and they piped it to the rest of the moon base because it's
why not?
Probably pretty – right, exactly. I mean, people have got to be working. There wasn't that big of a crowd there.
No.
But they had printed programs, which does imply that it was maybe a little more formal than just Johnny come sitar.
I'm sure it was. I mean, it wasn't just a little, let's all get, you know, get together and, you know, and just some informal thing. I'm sure.
I love that they had the resources to go ahead and print.
I know that part. That part I thought was kind of amusing that they actually printed that out. But nonetheless, I actually really liked the concept of the concert there. You know, this is the Alphans trying to find some way to have a sense of normalcy as they go trekking through the universe on the moon. I mean, I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. To me, it seems like a very human thing to do.
And real normalcy is Koenig scowling at the back of the audience.
Well,
there.
Yeah, the
first camera angle. He's like, "Why am I here? Oh God!"
There's a later one. He seems to be smiling.
It's a vague. Yeah, it's a slight smile, whereas the audience seems to be kind of a little more into it than Koenig. But you know, he's a bit square.
Yeah, a bit.
I'll tell you one science department they have not got on Moonbase Alpha. Before we get into this, hydroponics.
Yeah.
And do you know why they don't have hydroponics on Moonbase Alpha?
I could only imagine why.
Because every plant we saw in the section labeled hydroponics, every plant we saw that in the section where they called it hydroponics repeatedly in this episode had soil.
Yes, there was soil. I noticed, yes.
There were no hydroponics at all.
Yeah, there was no true hydroponics going on. I noticed that also. Yeah, I just decided to let that one go because I figure it's just one more thing in a whole list of things that are going to be weird.
I loved the set.
Oh, it was a good-looking set.
It didn't make much sense because they were just sort of, it looked more like a botanical section, and I obviously it is a botanical section in a way, but in other words, it didn't look like those things that they were growing there underneath the big windows were, it looked more like it was meant to be a place to go visit and enjoy plants, you know, sort of.
Almost like a nursery of sorts.
Yeah, it wasn't organized. It wasn't like we're growing food in here or that we're growing important resources. It looked like some place where you go and have a picnic.
I could see that.
And the arboretum. That's what I'm looking for. It looked more like an arboretum than it did a hydroponics lab.
I would agree with that.
But I liked it, and it reminded me of Silent Running.
Yes, the wall kind of gave me that feel that I thought the same thing too, that, oh, that looks like it could have been one of the domes from Silent Running. So, yes, I noticed that as well.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll put it on the line. I actually enjoy this episode. I have a lot to laugh about in the episode, as we see in many of them. But I actually enjoy this one. It is just wacky enough that I want to give it the benefit of the doubt and go, okay, they tried something really different here.
Mm-hmm. They were definitely going for a different kind of mood. There was a lot of things to – that's why I said that I love the aesthetics of the episode. And also at the same time, I got the sense that this was feeling more like a ghost story slash horror kind of episode, which I did not have a problem with. Couple all that. I mean, yes, so there are definitely things about this which I did enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, it's just when they're doing their darndest to shoehorn it into, this is not ghosts. Damn it, this is science.
Yes. And, yes, that was my problem too.
And you know, we had this, well, not you and I, but Simon and I did some time again with the, is it Nigel Neal? I think it's Nigel Neal. Forgive me if it isn't. The Stone Tape.
Oh, okay.
Which, yeah, you know, is postulating that there's some sort of resonance that gets from the psychic energy of traumatic events that gets stored in the stones of old castles and rocks, mm-hmm, and things, and that can be pulled back. And of course, that's, you know, okay. Subsequently pretty much demonstrated to be complete nonsense, but, you know, perhaps, even when this Space 1999 episode was going, I'm going to say it was still sort of a credible area of research. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is anymore. I think we have thoroughly tested and debunked enough of the psychic stuff now that, you know, you should just pretty much dismiss it out of hand. But looking back on an episode made in 1973 or four, I think it's 1974 because coincidentally, yeah, this episode...
it's like the first episode of the new year, wasn't it? Or something
major
like that.
Filming... Major production of principal photography, that's the term I said, started on my 10th birthday, so 1974. And I just ran across that while I was reading the article. I'm going, oh, that was my 10th birthday, woo. But anyway, I sort of kind of try to give it a pass in the science-y department, but...
And I've seen, and I'm glad you brought that up because I have seen other shows that have done a good job of being able to take, you know, the big supernatural thing what looks to be very supernatural slash paranormal, and I want to get on that a little bit later, and then give it a good scientific spin and pull it off really, really well. I felt this episode, they try, and I wanted to like it. I wanted to like it for that. Mm, yeah, so. Oh, well.
And there's the, yeah, the whole, I mean, we might as well just beat this particular topic down, because this one is, so, you know, from my 2017 perspective, looking back on it, it's obviously nonsense. But looking at it from a 1974 perspective, you know, there were real scientists thinking that there was real phenomena at the time, and yet we have the scientists on Alpha who are expressing skepticism about the idea. Not much skepticism, because they're cooed in pretty good by the difference between the words supernatural and paranormal. There is a distinction between supernatural and paranormal. By definition, supernatural is beyond the natural. Okay, I mean that by definition says that it is outside natural, and science is the study of natural, and so therefore anything that is by definition supernatural cannot be studied by science, and therefore cannot be proven to be real. And if you can prove it to be real, then it is natural, not supernatural, right? Paranormal generally is the grouping of those, was probably an exercise in semantics at the time when it was coined to try to specifically encapsulate certain phenomena of the mind or perceived phenomena of the mind, precognition, telekinesis, life of the consciousness beyond death, in a scientific way, as opposed, quote unquote, scientific way. I'm air quoting that if you can't see it, which obviously no one can. And at the time, paranormal was meant to be a more scientifically provable thing. They believed that the things that they were testing paranormally were measurable and therefore natural, not supernatural. So there is a distinction there, or there was a distinction there. But having utterly debunked paranormal phenomena, they are now supernatural phenomena as well.
In my mind, I've always equated the two as being just synonymous.
Yeah. They're not quite meant to be, but they
maybe
are
not originally, but I think now they are.
Right. And
you're right. And because of that, I had a little bit of an issue when Victor was trying to differentiate supernatural versus paranormal. And I was looking at it with present day sensibility and thought, and how is that different?
I had to go back and listen to what he said three times in a row to make sure I understood what he was saying. When they said, but you must understand, Professor Bergman, we cannot ascribe to any supernatural confirmism. We're not subscribing to any supernatural theory. And just with regards to supernatural, yes, but paranormal, no. And I'm like, wait.
What?
Did he just say yes, no, no, yes, yes, wait?
Yeah, exactly.
It was backwards because of the way the question was phrased about you're not ascribing to a theory. Yes, we're not ascribing to a theory. No, paranormal, but no, not. And like, okay, wait, what? Okay, no. But I think, you know, it's telling that they had to make that differentiation in the episode, that they wanted to make sure that we understood that Bergman is talking about the scientific study of psychic-y stuff. And there are several points in this story. Helena says it. Bergman says it. Psychic energy is a real thing that has been measured and exists.
Right.
It's not a theoretical thing. We know that this waveform matches the waveforms of psychic energy, which to me sounds like somebody must have measured psychic energy so that they can say this looks the same.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So,
But again, to isolate just that one thing, I let that one slide from a purely I guess you could call it a retroactive sort of point of view, because I know that this is something that the show has, or I don't think I think this is the first time we've actually visited this kind of MacGuffin.
You know,
I know there's another episode coming up next year where we see this, but I don't remember us seeing this prior.
I just sort of vaguely recall, and I for the life of me can't remember where it is, and it could be I'm completely wrong, or I'm thinking of, you know, The Prisoner or Star Trek or something, but I just sort of vaguely recall having that discussion with you that you know, there was some point where Helena said, oh, you know, so-and-so's ESP scores are higher than the other people. Which, again, in the 1970s, it was an exciting, early 70s, it was an exciting area of research for a lot of people. So, obviously, that's going to be grabbed on by writers and go, woohoo, look what we can do here.
Yeah.
Now, we might as well continue on those things. Now, the part that gets me is that there is a huge amount of, also, Bergman equating it to ghostly phenomena. And, you know, he even points out at one point, well, you know, I mean, we have to look at exercising this spirit. And Koenig says, you mean bell, book, and candle, which is a very British phrase.
Right.
You'll never, to my knowledge, you'll never hear anybody in this country.
I've never heard of it before.
You hear it all the time in Britain. Whenever anybody talks about doing the witchcraft thing, it's always bell, book, and candle. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's from a particular piece of literature or something that they, you know, Narnia or something that they've all collectively got in their mindset. But it's not one we normally refer to.
Oh, I've seen a lot of horror films.
Hammer films will mention bell, book, and candle all the time.
Yeah, but I haven't seen a Hammer film since I was a teenager, so I don't remember any of it. The more modern day horror films that deal with possessions and visitations and stuff like that, they're all American based. So and of course, obviously they never use that. So what, I mean, the candle, I suppose, and we can just, you know, we understand what that is, but bell book, I have no
bell,
clue.
Bell, comma, book, and candle.
Oh.
The bell, ding, 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 the bell, the book of spells, the candles, bell, book, and candle.
Okay. So it's a
reference
it's
to the trappings of witchcraft. Yeah.
Okay. I was gonna say it's a witchcraft thing.
Incantations.
Okay.
Yes. Bell, book, and candle. And, I assume it's a book of incantations. It could be the Bible. Could be the book of Satan. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it has a pentagram.
It's a religious text.
Yes. Of some kind. And then he goes on to say, you know, there are certain, there are certain trappings, the pentagram, certain symbols, certain things that are universally pop up, and we have to do that. And then, having convinced Koenig of that, he proceeds to set up something
not like it at all.
Not at all remotely like it.
Well, he does give a weird justification. And it's very bizarre, but you're right. I mean, what we do end up getting is like totally different. But he does kind of say that they have to kind of use sort of like their modern day equivalents to, you know, the old, you know, Gothic, Dark Ages, Spanish Inquisition kind of rubbish. But yeah, you're right. What we did get didn't even resemble that. I mean, I could not draw a parallel.
No,
at all.
You know, something, if he had come back and he said, I've placed these 5 death ray emitters
in a pentagram
form.
I would have seen the connection, but not even that. There's only 4, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. There's only the 4, and there's no mention of it. There's no, it just, you know, he's just using the words to evoke the creepy, ghosty thing to the audience is really what it's about. And that part was kind of annoying to me. Mm-hmm. Also, of course, is the oft-quoted, well, we only use approximately 18% of our brains.
Oh, that is such – that is so tired and so incorrect. But again
– what do we do with the other 82%?
Well, again, we got to think about when this was done. I mean, we look at it now and we understand.
And who,
you know,
it was done by.
Right.
Not people who know anything about it. Yeah.
No. But even then, you know, what was being put out there by the medical community was grossly miscommunicated and probably very misunderstood at the same time.
I believe that whole 18% thing was based on some basic person made some statement about something that may have been partially accurate, but just completely wildly taken and run with. Mm-hmm. And of course, people in the psychic, the paranormal investigation love it because, you know, what's the other
82%?
Where's the 82% of your brain? What's it up there doing? Obviously, it's doing psychic-y stuff, which is great. I'm glad my brain is conducting incredible psychic powers all the time with most of my brain, and I don't get any benefit out of that whatsoever. But yeah. Another thing I'm just going to say is that also Professor Bergman, that great, wonderful scientist that he is.
Ah!
You know, plants are a lot like us, John. We both have nervous systems. We experience hunger. We feel pain. Even happiness.
Well, like, great. That's nice to know that they feel pain. I'll remember that the next time I eat a carrot.
Obviously, that's also the realm of some pretty. There are people who think plants feel pain.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are people still that say, I talk to my plants, that's why they do so well, or I play them, you know, like the music of Mozart or something like that. And
that's what we're doing here. I mean, that's what this experiment from Mateo's is
yeah.
It's brain to plant to thing. But okay, plants don't have nerves.
No,
I'm just gonna go out here and say there are people who are going to say no, plants have a nervous system. It's like no, plants
no,
do
don't.
Not have nerves. They do not have a system of nerves. Therefore, they do not have a nervous system. They may have, for the sake of scientific purity, they may have things that transmit electrical impulses along the way, but it is not a nervous system as we understand.
Not as
it.
We know it. Nope.
Right, it is a different thing that is not, and to compare our nervous system to these pathways that may conduct electricity, they don't feel hunger, sorry, because they don't feel as we understand the term feel. And again, you can ascribe anything you want to the word feel, but by what we understand it to mean in real terms, they don't, and therefore not happiness. But again, this goes back to, I talk nicely to my plants and they grow better. I talk nicely to water and it forms better crystals.
I sing to my water and I get better ice cubes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's all kind of a bit of nonsense that at the time was less nonsensey.
So, I mean, I could understand how certain sound waves could be destructive, possibly, to the cellular structure of a plant if they're loud enough and of a certain frequency. Yeah, I could see how. I mean,
or perhaps even beneficial to growth.
Yeah,
I don't know. I could
accept that. But the whole but with Victor going off into the whole nervous system thing, to me seemed really out there, even for 74.
So the next thing along that line is Dan Mateo and his incredibly important experiments, which could mean life or death to the Alphans. If we could just communicate with the plants, it could be the margin for survival that we need.
So let's take that a little bit further. If we
what exactly is that?
Well, that's saying if we can communicate to the plants to tell them to really grow and reproduce, we can eat them.
That's the best I could come up with, too. It's like plants, tasty, juicy, large.
Yeah.
Could you look? We'll continue to feed you as long as you
so
continue
we can
to feed you.
You. Yeah, I mean.
Otherwise, if we die, you die here in space. So I think it's hugely beneficial.
Grow,
but I mean, yeah, to think that this is going to be the difference between life and death on Alpha,
but extreme.
It was just and for him to be so monomaniacally committed to this idea, which just I'm not getting it, and
no.
I feel like now. At the same time, Warren, supposedly the more level-headed scientist, don't do this. It's dangerous. Why?
Why is it dangerous?
Why did you think it was dangerous? And we never got the opportunity to explain it. Was it like, ooh, they're doing like a seance and that's like scary? And I know, ghosts,
it's
Commander Koenig, that's the only thing I can think of. But we never get a chance for him to tell Koenig that. He's just like, well, it's dangerous, And I don't know whether that's supposed to be like professional jealousy. He doesn't want him to succeed in the department and do something, and so he's trying to sabotage it, or is he scared? Or
I don't know, but that's something that we saw a lot of in this episode where, I mean, when we first see Koenig, I mean, okay, yeah, Victor then kind of fills in the gaps later on in the episode, but when Koenig is first investigating this incident, all we hear about is this experiment that Mateo is doing. All we hear about is that Dr. Warren is very, very much opposed to it. And at no point is Koenig saying, what experiment? Why is it bad?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I don't see it on here. Yeah.
I would have liked it.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because here's an episode where Koenig didn't actually save the day. I'm just going to point that out. But while I'm thinking about it, his hero clause must have gotten a little exercising in this one because he didn't really do anything. He didn't even conduct a very good investigation. There was one thing I will point out that's keeping with John Koenig's usual modus operandi. So during the concert, they have the thing. There's the wind that blows throughout Alpha. We see it blow down the hallways. We see girls' hairs blown all over the place. It goes into command center and or main mission and it blows their hair all over the place and newspapers flying all over the bits. And then it gets into the auditorium or whatever we want to call it, the concert hall, and it blows those people and then it stops. And then, ooh, right? I mean, Koenig's right there in the room when that happened. Mm-hmm. People who are in main mission are right there. There's technicians, there's stuff blown all over the place. It's like, okay, there's absolutely no one ever mentions the wind. They always mention
the drop in temperature.
The drop in temperature. They never mention the wind. And we get this bit where Kano says, yes, the computer measured a drop in temperature in all the sections of Alpha Commander that occurred at the time of the thing, originating in the hydroponic section. First in the hydroponic section, and it tells us the computer can tell us everything we want to know about this except what caused it. And you know, everyone's kind of like, typical computer.
Yeah.
Which I'm thinking, well, okay, so they've got temperature gauges all over the base and they measured the temperature. This was never in doubt. I mean, except for the question of why they didn't ask about the wind. But Koenig is standing in hydroponics and he looks over at one of the plants. And it looks like it has frost damage. And he says to Victor, well, the drop in temperature wasn't imaginary. Something to that effect. Or wasn't a aberration of the computer. It's like, wow. Here we are. You still don't trust the computer. Measures a temperature differential, which you all feel. You all feel the wind blowing on you and everything else throughout Alpha. The man, you know, collapsed in the scientific experiment and this stuff like stuff, and you have all this data at your hand, and yet you didn't believe that the temperature dropped until you saw some frost damage on some of the plants. Man, that's a deep distrust.
It occurs to me, well, if we're going to talk about the wind, it occurs to me,
I'd have been checking all the air seals.
That would have been my first guess. You know, right? there's a leak. There's a pressure leak. I mean, you're on the moon, you're in space, it's a vacuum out there. That's the first thing I'd be doing to see if there's any kind, you know, if there's some kind of depressurization going on. But I have a feeling that psychic energy manifestations come off as wind.
So psychic energy is a fart.
Basically.
Okay. Psychic energy is God's farts. Space God's farts.
So I'm wondering if this is somebody's idea, Jerry Anderson's, I don't know, but someone's idea that, well, how do you show psychic energy? Oh, I know. Let's turn a fan on.
I would be willing to buy that, save for one thing. And I'm not saying it's good at manifestation, but, you know,
terrible.
You're stretching and you're doing
it,
good.
I admit I'm stretching it.
No,
I admit it's a stretch.
I appreciate that you're trying to come up with a way to justify this. And you know how you could – you get in close, maybe you put some weird lighting on them and you blow their hair a little bit. That gives the illusion that maybe, you know, maybe it's electricity. Maybe it's something else doing the hair or something like that. I mean, I can get that wind effect to create some sort of a dramatic effect on the person. And if it hadn't been blowing papers off of desks,
I
would have bought that.
But see, the psychic energy is creating – again, it there is a physical effect, And that's the best I can come up with. I'm not saying it's a good one.
You know, I mean, if they had mentioned the fact that stuff had been blown around or that their hair got messed up or something. But instead, it's as if the writers wrote a cold spell snaps through Alpha and everyone shivers. And the director said, we can do better than that. Get out the wind machine. And they didn't change a word of dialogue.
No, no. Like I said, that's why I keep coming back to the concept of psychic energy. Somebody, you know, and I'm not saying it's a good one. I'm saying it's a terrible one. But somebody has got this idea that, ooh, we need to show psychic energy. I know the greatest way to do it is just let's get a bunch of fans and turn them on.
Let's talk about the other manifestations of our psychic psychic creature. There are a few spots where he's shadowy, the ghostly, and I thought those were very
spooky,
nice, and spooky.
Yeah. Well done.
Although I was a little unclear. So the first time we see it, it's just a head and shoulders that Mateo sees over somewhere in sickbay for a second as he's going out or he's being sedated. The next time we see it, first, Helena sees the shadowy figure, but then when the door opens, the shadowy figure now looks like a real person. I mean, there's a guy standing there. He's not glowing. He's not transparent. He's not shadowy. There's a guy standing there.
Yeah. And he's silhouetted.
When she opens the door, I mean, you can see the color of his clothes and stuff. He's not, and the only reason you can't see his face is because he's got his arm positioned out in front of it. So you can't recognize him. That scene. Right?
Yes.
Now he's a man. He was silhouetted in the window, but as soon as the door opens, he's standing.
Now we actually can see him.
So now they've established that this thing is a guy. He's not a shadow. He's a guy who casts a shadow, right? So on the travel tube, Mateo gets on the travel tube, and the door won't close, which is a nice little touch. I don't know what it means, but it's a nice touch.
I mean, it's just a nice touch, yeah.
And if something's wrong here, it's the thing getting in, and it's too slow to jump on the thing by itself, so the door jams on it, and maybe it tries to hold it for a second, and then it leaps on the travel tube with him. But the way it's shot, he sees the shadow on the wall at the opposite end of the tube. Then he sees the shadow kind of standing up, kind of heading his way. And then we see a reverse shot of him, and the thing's shadow is on him, right? And he's, like, terrified.
Right.
Is there more in that room than the shadow? Because we're not shown what's casting the shadow that's on him, but it's now on the opposite side of the carriage, and he's looking at whatever is, presumably he's looking at what casts the shadow. But because they don't show it to us, I would assume that it's just shadows if it hadn't been that we'd already seen it as a humanly manifest form in Dr. Russell's office. And that scene confused me for that reason. Like, I can't tell whether the guy is walking in front of him or whether it's just shadows in the room. It's freaking him out.
I kind of took it when Mateo was in the travel tube. Like, we only see the shadow. I had just assumed that there was an actual individual in the tube with Mateo, and we were only being privileged to see the shadow, you're right. It doesn't – from a storytelling standpoint, I mean, that scene would have made better sense except for the – you know, if Helena had not seen the fully formed person.
Yes. Yes, because, you know, it's a spirit. It's a non-corporeally thing, or at least
if she had only seen if she had not seen the fully formed entity, then right. I would have assumed that all Mateo was seeing was the shadow.
Wouldn't have questioned it for a second. Exactly,
I would have left it alone. Now I'm thinking, okay, there's someone in the travel tube with him. It's the only thing I can come up with. But why are we not allowed to see him?
And obviously, it's partially to not give the reveal that it's Mateo.
Well, they didn't have to. I mean, there are other ways they could have done that. You know, there's so many ways they could have shown it. Just like we could see him from the behind, just see his back. You know, take the camera angle just right, so that we're like kind of looking around this thing's back. it's off at
over
an angle,
shoulder or anything,
over a shoulder, something, so that we could see that there's somebody standing over Mateo or about to. I mean, there's all sorts of ways they could have done it, but no, they went for the shadowy thing, which again, by itself, is a nice kind of spooky, eerie touch, but from a linear standpoint, is a little inconsistent.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. That was my thought. It's like, I enjoyed the shadowy cinematography much better than I did when the thing becomes manifest.
In fact, I would have wished that we did not get the full manifestation until much later on in the episode, like when they're having the seance.
Well, and when they have the seance and when Mateo pops up and stands there and he actually talks to them, you know, walking around the circle and then sort of goes, Bergman, to see if he can get him to, I don't know, was he trying to get him to break the circle?
That's what I thought.
I'm not 100% sure I understand these things because, you know.
I don't believe in them.
That doesn't mean that I haven't studied them because I find it kind of fascinating. But I think, if my recollection is correct, that not breaking the circle does two things. It allows the energy to continue to flow unbroken, which is what allows the manifestation to continue. But it also contains it and keeps the people safe. And so if Bergman had, for example, broken hands when the thing shouted at him from behind his head, then perhaps they would have been in danger. But as long as they can, because the first thing I think is probably Koenig's is don't let go of hands. You know, keep holding your hands. Which would be back to the bell, book, and candle kind of stuff. And, but I don't know if that's what they were going for, because they basically shot every bit of mysticism out of this. You know, everything that they tried to present as kind of supernaturally ghosty, they tried to scientificize. And so...
Yeah, I can only infer what it's supposed to mean.
It's
and
no longer a protective circle. It's
maybe the thought is, and again, it would have been nice if this had been addressed to put it in some kind of more scientific frame of reference, but possibly the argument could be made. And again, I'm going for a huge stretch here. You know, I'm not saying that this is what they were doing, but it's possible that maybe much like, you know, when we look at Star Trek, you know, every time Spock wanted to do a mind meld, a really effective one, he always had to touch his the person he wishes to communicate with. Yeah, like touch the Hordo, or you know, you have to touch the face of whoever it is that he's linking to, you know, making the telepathic contact. It's possible that maybe we were seeing something along those kinds of lines. This is a being of some kind of psychic nature. It can attack with psychic energy by creating the circle. They're sort of joining their minds in such a way that maybe they create some kind of mental gestalt that protects them. Who knows?
Yeah. It's just, you know, it seems like it's a holdover from it. In many ways, this episode feels like it may have had a rewrite. And it was probably a lot more... a lot more spiritualistic or ghosty or witchcrafty, and somebody went through and gave it a kind of a science polish, and this is kind of leftover that they just didn't bother to discuss in that whole don't break the circle, you know, don't cross the streams, don't break the circle, whatever little bit of magical nonsense you need to have to get it go. So, but you know, when it appeared and it was Mateo in makeup, and he's like, yeah, that is who I was once, or whatever the heck he says. I was once who you say. You know, you did this to me, vengeance for the collective act that destroyed my existence. You know, at that point, I'm kind of didn't like it. I didn't like the way they did it, because it's just a guy standing there. And I don't know, that's... make him translucent or something. I mean, I know they had the ability to do that because we've seen.
Well, we see
him
at one point. Yeah, we do see through him at.
Well, I mean, in other episodes where they just had people who were just, you know, faded out in the background,
Well, we see him fade in, so yeah, they could have kept him like that, and it might have made. I mean, it's a very easy technique.
Yeah, so it
to
just,
do that, just double exposure.
It made it seem like this is not a psychic phenomenon anymore, but this is actually a manifestation of something that's physically real that you could touch and.
Right, and that's where the whole thing just kind of deteriorates for me.
Yeah. So
now I just did a lookup on the writer, at least on IMDb.
Johnny Byrne, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a Johnny Byrne. He's the only person who is getting a screenplay. That's not to say that there couldn't be another writer in there, because there are script doctors, script fixers, who are paid to do rewrites and repairs, and because of the nature of their job, they never get any credit.
It's
possible that there was a rewrite being done here, but for legal reasons, there's no credit for it, because it does feel like that this tried to be originally this kind of a story, and then at some point it feels like it's trying to be something else.
Yeah. So I didn't really care for that bit. And of course, that makes it a lot easier when Mateo and Mateo are fighting each other, because if they're two physically manifest beings, then it's easier for them to grab each other around the neck.
Well, also, you want scarred Mateo to be a physical manifestation. Otherwise, how can he be affected by these
death rays?
Death rays, yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, and that's the other thing. I thought maybe at first when Bergman says we're going to have to, you know, do like an exorcism, and it's going to be stuff, and then suddenly he says, but it's not going to be the stuff you use in an exorcism, obviously. It's going to be something else completely. And I thought maybe he was going to be talking about, like, let's go science-y here. How about a wave-canceling projector that works at an alternate resonance to the psychic frequency, which they know what it is?
You know, I would have accepted that.
See,
much
then it was like,
more readily.
We should be able to suppress this creature because it's manifest of this wavelength, and we can do a wave cancellation.
Exactly.
Boom. But no, instead we put in these death fields, which he actually says, basically, that they're deadly.
Yeah, because no one is allowed to go into that room because they would be killed by them.
Right. So it's obviously a death ray. And the fact that the ghost struggles with Mateo and throws him into the death ray to kill him, creating itself, wasn't quite sure how that worked out. It seems to me like either Mateo should have thrown himself into the death ray.
Yeah.
Or he should have been trying to push the ghost into the death ray, and the ghost should have been trying to push him out of the death ray. But it didn't look like that. It looked the opposite. It looked like he was trying to not be pushed into the death ray, and the ghost was trying to push him into the death ray. But I couldn't tell, because they were just sort of back and forth with their arms around each other and or each other's necks. And it was, a little weird, but obviously it had to happen because it was preordained by Space God, who didn't get a mention in this episode, but hey.
Now,
one other that I want to go to. In the Helena Russell Fabulous Doctor department, his spinal cord has been shattered. This could not have been done by a blow. It's as if fear was unimaginably concentrated.
You know, that is not the first time I have heard that being addressed. I actually
Space 1999 or elsewhere?
Elsewhere.
Okay.
There was a very, very bad horror film that came out. I'm not sure what year. I'd have to look it up. But it starred Vincent Price and was called The Tingler. And yeah, well – do you know the movie I'm talking about?
I don't know the donkey you're talking about, but I believe that's a brand of condom.
Well, okay. Well, you just ruined this little concept here.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is, it poses that people who started to experience paralyzing fear had their necks broken, or there was some sort of nerve damage that happened along in the neck. And Vincent Price plays his doctor, and he said, you know, they started doing these x-rays of these people, and he conducts some very unethical experiments, putting them in great fear just so that he could X-ray what they were going through. And as the fear escalated, he was like taking, you know, X-ray shot after X-ray after X-ray after X-ray. And there was this thing that started to grow on people's backs until death, at which point it then vanished. And so he then finds a person who – oh, no, unless a person screams, because the sound of scream would seem to alleviate whatever it is that was growing. Uh-huh. So he finds a person who is mute and subjects her to paralyzing fear. And right as she is at the point of death, he operates on her and pulls this thing. It's a monster, basically, that grew inside of – it grows inside of all humans. So again, a long story short, it's been addressed in past horror films. So I'm wondering if maybe somebody didn't see that film and thought, oh, well, maybe we can use that here.
Well, I'm just going to say The Tingler was 1959.
Thank you.
71% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is by legendary horror director William Castle. So
it's terrible. It's a bad movie. And I like horror films, but this one really stinks.
Really interesting.
I think it's awful.
The Tingler is legendary horror director William Castle's magnum opus. After the success of The House on Haunted Hill, Castle devised a new gimmick. So some people like it, apparently. I haven't heard of it. But again, I mean, I'm just, you know, what... Where does she pull that out of her rear, other than out of her rear? Because his spinal cord is crushed up. Must have been crushed by fear. Is that because your muscles clamp up so much that you break your own back? I don't know. It's like, of all the things she could possibly have said, how about not say anything at all? How about, like, gosh, John, I don't know, his spinal column has been completely crushed. Nothing I can think of could do that. How about
which
that one?
Would have much actually – it would have been better, and it would have fit with pretty much everything else that Helena has ever said on that show, because she basically does not know anything.
But here she has managed to come up with one hell of a diagnosis.
And,
like,
and
they just
bollocks.
Take it. And they just take it. I was like, oh, fascinating, Helena. Go on. It's like – she should have just said, you know, it couldn't have been a blow that destroyed his spinal cord like that. Helen, John, I think he tied his shoelaces too tightly. Like, oh, all right, Helena, I guess I'll take your medical opinion for it. I mean, I don't take your medical opinion on anything else whenever it goes against what my preconceived notion is. But okay, I'll take this one. We love the crew of Moonbase Alpha. We really do. We really do. When they have the alert in hydroponics, I love the fact that they're standing in main mission. An alert goes off. Temperature drop. Hydroponics section commander. And what does Koenig do?
He says,
Alan, come with me.
Alan, come with me. Yeah.
Not, hey, Kano, send security. Not, get me a security guard and take you in there. No. Nothing like that. How about an emergency response team that's not John Koenig? You know, there's probably security probably closer to hydroponics that could have gotten there first. But no. It's like, hey, Alan, come with me. Like, all right, Commander, I'm ready for a fight at any time.
Because I'm the angry Aussie.
Yeah. Well, at least Alan got something to do. I mean, he was at the concert. And he was at the seance, so he wasn't completely shut out.
Right.
Okay. What else do we have?
The big thing is this entity. What is it? I mean, okay, we understand that it's Mateo, but this future ghostly Mateo, how far from the future did it come from? And, oh, is this now a time travel episode?
Well, obviously it came from right at the end of the hour when it got killed. I assume that when it died in Bergman's psychic death ray, That is what...
That's when it got sent back in time.
Is time a illusion to psychic phenomena? I don't know.
That's where it just really completely blew up for me.
Okay, so...
You know, and the problem is that even as Koenig is trying to understand what happened, all we got was some empty rhetoric about how life and death are still the big mysteries.
Right, and I
have to admit, I don't like that. I know that we talked about how the idea with Space 1999 is for them to go out to the universe and then to understand how much they don't know.
And I think I very much think that this episode is of many episodes that we see. This one is spelling it out more than anything else. I wrote a lot of this stuff down that Koenig said. I mean, you know, he's sulking in hydroponics, and Helena comes in, and we get perfectly fine bit of dialogue. Every death on Alpha is personal to me. Mateo's was just a bit more, and I think he's right there because his actions did ultimately kill. The commands that he gave killed Mateo. And so, you know, I think compared to, say, somebody who just got blown out an airlock, or, you know, an alien showed up and shot somebody, that's not really Koenig's fault. I understand that. But in this case, I can see how he's doing. So he's, you know, he's rightfully in a sort of pensive, philosophical, deep mood. And Helena's trying to give him that nonsense. Well, it was preordained. I mean, obviously it had to have happened because it was his own dead ghost did the thing. So, I mean, there was no way it couldn't have happened. It had to happen that way. And it is that line. It's like life after death, maybe, maybe not, but haunted by your own ghost before you're even dead. What's that all about? I mean, that's his line. What's that all about? That is like, that is actually what they should write as the summary on the DVD box set for Space 1999. What's that all about? You know, it's like, we've gone to an antimatter planet where parrots live and dead people rematerialize and things crash and then they come back. What's that all about?
Yeah, that really needs to be the tagline for every episode.
We came to this planet that didn't have a name because our computer is too stupid, and then they fighters at us and we blow it up, and they blow up most Alpha and they kill us, and we go to the planet and we destroy their whole planet, and then none of it happened. What's that all about? It's like we could just go on all day. In fact, I think from now on, at the end of every episode where it's appropriate, I'm going to do that. It's like Moonbase Alpha. What's that all about?
Hey, it's like, you know, the black sun. The moon goes through the black sun. Everybody turns kind of ethereal. You got the eagle that's flying off into the opposite direction. All of a sudden, next thing you know, it's landing on the moon. What's that all about?
Right. And you know what ruins this? And you already mentioned it, but I'll cap it in. It's then Helena babbling on after he says that. That should have been the last line. He'll haunt himself after he's dead. What's that all about? And she goes, "Oh, you know, the mystery's death. It's the things we don't know." It's like, "Oh, you really didn't need to say that because at this point, acknowledging the fact that this is completely nonsensical on Koenig's part, it's like, was all we needed, and they should have just ended it right there and put, you know, produced by Jerry Anderson and gone off into the end credit music. But
yeah,
And yet I enjoy the episode because it's kind of fun to watch, and it's got the sitar playing throughout a lot of it.
This is what I wrote in my notes. Part of me very much wants to like this episode. There were several aesthetics that were part of the overall episode that made it stand out. We saw a return of some mood lighting. Mateo's future ghost was creepy in a gross sort of way, and the use of the sitar music helped to generate an eerie mood. It tried to be a horror/ghost story, but the execution in terms of the science was pitiful, which only made the episode rather hollow.
Unless you have anything else.
I don't have a thing. I think we've pretty much covered it.
I do indeed. So, Ben, thank you for joining me.
A pleasure.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it. if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, FusionPatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle, @FusionPatrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.